Picture this. It's February 2026. You're in Beijing in one of those, ultra-modern conference rooms, all glass and steel.
Right, in the financial district.
Exactly. And a chief risk officer at one of China's biggest state-backed banks, he sits down with his tablet. He's probably thinking about inflation numbers, the housing market, the usual stuff.
But that is not what he
That's
sees.
quote.
He opens a file that's just labeled urgent, and it's a direct instruction from the NFRA.
The National Financial Regulatory Administration, so the top dogs.
The top dogs. And the memo, well, it doesn't have exclamation points, but you can feel it screaming. It basically says, show your exposure to Venezuela. Get ready for losses.
Yeah, ready for losses. I mean, that's a phrase that would just make any banker's blood run cold. Because for a decade, the whole game in Beijing was built on one big assumption.
A pretty sturdy one for a while.
Yeah, that contracts outlive politics.
Exactly. The strategy was so clear. Lend to the countries the West cuts off. You go to Venezuela, Iran, Russia, and you become their lender of last resort. The thinking was, they need us. They have nowhere else to go, so we'll always get paid back.
But today, we're diving into why that assumption is, well, it's snapping in half. We've got a pile of reports and some pretty dense legislative texts here that show this huge shift happening under the
A
surface.
massive shift.
Yeah.
Because that whole system China built, this sort of shadow barter system to trade with sanctioned states, it worked. It was incredibly profitable.
Until it wasn't. What our sources are showing is this sudden new hidden interest rate on all those loans. And it's not just a market thing. It's a very specific strategy from the U.S. combined with the explosive instability of the very regimes China bet on.
A pincer movement, really.
Right. So that's our mission for this deep dive. First, we have to unpack the old way. We need to really get into the nuts and bolts of how Beijing was running this barter-style trade using something called the China Track.
Yeah, you have to see how the machine worked before you can understand why it's breaking.
Then we're going to look at the hammer that's breaking it, Section 1273 of a new U.S. Defense Act. And finally, the really fascinating part succession risk. What on earth happens to your loans when the dictator you lent billions to suddenly isn't there anymore?
Which leads to this incredible twist where China, of all countries, starts turning to Western international law to try and save its money.
It's a wild story. So let's start with the old way, because I think a lot of people just assume sanctions mean, trade stops, the U.S. says no, and that's it. But China saw it as a business opening.
Oh, absolutely. A massive one. You have to remember, Western sanctions pushed countries like Iran and Russia out of the normal financial world. They couldn't use SWIFT, they couldn't clear dollars. Most banks looked at that and just ran away.
Which makes total sense. Who wants to lend to a country that can't even use a bank?
China saw a vacuum. They stepped in and said, look, we'll take your oil, your gas, and we'll give you everything you need, goods, tech, infrastructure. It worked for both sides. China got cheap resources, and these sanctioned states got a lifeline.
Okay, but here's the question I always get stuck on, logistically. If you're a Russian energy company, you can't just send an invoice to Beijing and ask for a wire transfer. The U.S. Treasury is watching every dollar that moves, so how did they actually do it?
They had to get creative. They built what our sources are calling the China Track.
The China Track.
It's basically a highly sophisticated barter system that's just dressed up to look like modern banking.
Okay, the barter system. That sounds almost, I don't know, medieval, like trading chickens for wheat. How does that work with billions of dollars in oil?
Think of it like a netting arrangement. So
Yeah.
instead of money actually crossing a border for every single deal where it could get flagged, they just keep an internal ledger.
Like a running tab at a bar.
A giant multi-billion dollar tab. So a Russian bank and a Chinese bank, they set up this closed loop. Russia sends, say, $100 million worth of natural gas.
Okay.
China then sends $80 million worth of electronics back. Instead of money changing hands, they just adjust the numbers on their private ledger. China now owes a credit of $20 million.
So the cash never actually moves? It's just a number in a spreadsheet somewhere that no one else can see?
Exactly. It's totally opaque. A black box settlement system.
That's how they handle Russia. But the sources mention something different for Iran, these teapot refineries, which I have to say is a fantastic name.
It is a great name. And no, they're not serving tea. These are huge industrial sites. They're called teapots because historically they were these smaller independent refineries, not the massive state-owned giants.
And being independent helps them get around sanctions. How?
Because they don't have the same exposure. A huge bank like the Bank of China has branches in New York and London. They have a ton to lose if the U.S. Treasury gets angry and decides to cut them off from the dollar.
Right, they have too much skin in the game.
But a teapot refinery in some rural province, they don't have an office in Manhattan. They don't care about the U.S. financial system. All they want is cheap crude oil. So they became the perfect deniable buyers for Iranian oil.
I see. So the big state companies can keep their hands clean officially while the teapots do the actual dirty work.
That's the setup. They buy the sanctioned oil, usually at a huge discount, refine it, and sell it inside China. It let Beijing get all this energy without putting its major financial institutions at risk.
So for years, this whole ecosystem was humming along. China gets cheap oil. They get to be the savior for these isolated countries. The bet was that this connective tissue, the shipping companies, the insurers, all these little firms, was too messy to police.
That was the bet. But they missed the key vulnerability. You can hide a ledger entry on a computer. You can't hide a 2-million-barrel supertanker on the open ocean.
Right. You can't email crude oil. It has to physically move.
And you need ships for that. You need insurance. You need ports. This whole physical layer is the connective tissue. And that's exactly where the U.S. decided to strike.
Which brings us to the game changer. Section 1273 of the FY 2026 NDAA. Now, usually a title like that makes my eyes glaze over, but our sources are basically calling this an act of economic war. What does it actually do?
It's a real shift in thinking.
Yeah.
The full title says it all. Defending international security by restricting unacceptable partnerships and tactics.
Catchy?
It is. But what makes it so different is that it institutionalizes a new strategy. Before this, sanctions were kind of like whack-a-mole. You'd sanction one general or one particular bank.
And they just open up a new shell company the next day. We've seen it 100 times.
Exactly. Section 1273 changes the entire target. It says we are no longer looking at China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea as four separate problems. The law now treats them as a single, interconnected ecosystem.
An ecosystem. So you poke one part of it and the whole thing feels it.
That's the idea. The law literally mandates that the state, defense, treasury, and commerce departments form these permanent working groups. And their only job is to map, disrupt, and constrain the cooperation between these countries.
Map, disrupt, and constrain. That sounds incredibly proactive. It's not monitor and report.
No, it's offensive. It moves from punishing bad behavior after the fact to sustained interference. The U.S. is now explicitly targeting the predictability of repayment.
Okay, let's stop on that phrase because I think that's the whole ballgame. Predictability of repayment. Why is that the weak spot?
Well, think about being a lender. If I lend you money, I don't really care what you do with it as long as I'm certain you can pay me back. But the second I think your income might get shut off, I stop lending. Or I charge you an insane interest rate.
So the U.S. is deliberately trying to make the income stream unreliable.
Precisely. It's like squeezing a garden hose. They're not trying to plug the oil well in Iran. They're just squeezing the hose at every possible point. The shipping, the insurance, the port services.
So if a country like Venezuela or Iran can't actually get its oil onto a ship that's insured and cleared to sail,
then they can't make the money to pay China back. China is left holding this massive loan, but the actual cash flow needed to pay it back is being choked off by this constant, sustained interference.
The connective tissue becomes a battlefield.
Contested territory is the phrase one analyst used. It forces Beijing to realize that a contract is just a piece of paper if the money can't physically move.
Which brings us right back to that poor risk officer in Beijing. The fear isn't just about Venezuela. The sources are calling Venezuela the warning shot. The real nightmare is the succession risk in Iran and Russia.
And this is where the financial risk becomes a political one. We think of regime change as a political event, right? Who's in charge now? But if you're the main creditor, it's a terrifying financial liability.
This is that embedded political premium idea, right?
That's it. When you lend to a dictator, you aren't just betting on the country. You're betting on that specific person, that specific inner circle, staying in power forever.
But wait, sovereign debt is owed by the state, not the leader. If a new president is elected in France, France still pays its bonds. How is this different?
Because these aren't normal bonds traded on an open market. These are murky bilateral deals cut with sanctioned regimes. Let's just game this out. Scenario A, Iran. We're seeing reports of protests, inflation, internet blackouts, It's a powder keg.
Okay, so let's say the current regime falls apart.
What's the first thing a new government, any new government, is going to want? They'll want to get the sanctions lifted so the economy can breathe again.
Right. They need to get back in the world's good graces to survive.
And how do you signal you're different from the old guys? You look at all the deals they made, and you see billions and billions of dollars in debt owed to China.
And you could just say, that wasn't us. That was the corrupt old regime.
You got it. It's a classic revolutionary playbook. You declare those contracts illegitimate. You argue China wasn't helping the Iranian people. They were propping up a corrupt government in exchange for cheap oil.
So all those cheap barrels that look like a great deal for China?
A new government could reframe that as proof of complicity. They can say, you were funding our oppression.
Wow. So the asset becomes a liability overnight.
Exactly. And for a new Iranian government, tearing up Chinese contracts is a very cheap way to win points with the West. China is left holding worthless paper.
That is a staggering amount of risk. The debt is only good as long as that one guy is in power. But Russia has to be different, right? I mean, it's a huge nuclear power. China is their economic lifeline right now.
They are. China is Moscow's indispensable lender. But that's the problem. Let's think about scenario B, a post-Putin Russia.
One of the sources pointed out that a new leader in the Kremlin might have options China doesn't want them to have.
That's the whole game. What if a new Russian government comes in and says, this isolation is killing us. We want access to our hundreds of billions in frozen assets. We want to sell our gas to Europe again.
If that happens, China is no longer the only buyer in town.
China's leverage evaporates instantly. And it gets worse. The new Russian government could look at all those wartime deals and argue they were signed under duress.
Under duress? You mean they'd claim China took advantage of their desperation?
Why not? They could say, you only got that gas so cheap because we had no other choice. That wasn't a fair price. We're renegotiating.
So China goes from being Russia's savior to being a predatory lender holding politically toxic debt.
Politically radioactive. And a law like Section 1273 makes all of this more likely because it's actively stressing the system, making these fractures more probable.
It's just so ironic. We always hear that China plays the long game, these 50-year plans. But here, their entire long-term strategy depends on these incredibly fragile regimes just not changing.
It's a massive contradiction. And it leads to this final, really fascinating twist in how China is trying to protect itself legally.
Right. I love this part. Because when you think of China and international law, the word that comes to mind is skeptical.
To put it very mildly, I mean, remember the 2016 South China Sea ruling? An international court ruled against their claims, and Beijing's official response was basically, this piece of paper is irrelevant. We don't recognize your authority.
Yeah, the line was something like, sovereignty is non-negotiable.
But now, when it's about getting their money back from these shaky partners, suddenly, Beijing is the world's biggest fan of international legal conventions.
What changed? What are they doing?
They're using something called the 1958 New York Convention.
The 1958 New York Convention. Sounds like a treaty about, I don't know, regulating taxi cabs. What is it?
It's the absolute foundation of global business law. It's a treaty that says if you win a legal arbitration judgment in one member country, all the other member countries have to help you enforce it. And pretty much the whole world, 172 countries, has signed it.
So if you win a case in a court in, say, Singapore, you can use this treaty to go seize assets in London or Paris.
That's exactly what it's for. It's how you collect debts across borders. And China has been quietly embedding clauses that point to this convention into its loan agreements.
So when it's about territory, international law is Western interference. But when it's about collecting cash, they want the full protection of Western courts.
It's pure pragmatism. They know that arguing about sovereignty doesn't get your loan paid back. If a regime in Russia falls, China can't just sail a warship up the river and repossess a pipeline. That's how you start a world war.
A little too 19th century for today.
But with the New York Convention, they can go to a court in a neutral country and get an order to seize a Russian oil tanker or a bank account or a commercial airplane anywhere in the world.
That is incredible. They are leaning on the very legal system they claim to oppose just to hedge their bets on the anti-Western bloc they're trying to build.
It proves they know how real these risks are. They know contracts outlive politics is just a slogan unless you have a way to enforce them. And the only enforcement tool with global reach is the one built by the West.
Okay, so let's pull back for the big picture here. We started with one risk officer in Beijing having a very bad day. But this feels like it's about the entire future of globalization.
It is. It's about the real cost of doing business in this new era. For years, China thought it had found a cheat code for geopolitics. Bankroll the pariahs, use shadow finance to move the money, and lock up resources and influence.
But now Section 1273 and this whole succession risk problem have revealed that hidden interest rate.
And that interest rate is the risk that the political ground can just fall out from under you. Mm. It's the risk that the connective tissue of trade, the ships, the insurance, is now a legitimate military and economic target.
It's constant grinding disruptions, putting sand in the gears of their entire machine.
Day in and day out. Mm. And the takeaway for you, for anyone watching this space, is that there's no such thing as a purely economic deal anymore. A loan to a sanctioned state isn't just a number on a balance sheet. It's a political bet. And the odds on that bet are getting longer every day.
So here's the final question I want to leave you with. If this strategy, if Section 1273 actually works, if the U.S. makes it just too painful and expensive for China to maintain this shadow economy, what does Beijing do then?
That's the multi-trillion dollar question.
Do they give up and say, okay, fine, we'll play by the Western rules? Or do they go the other way? Do they try to build an entirely separate financial universe with their own shipping, their own insurance, their own banks, a system that never has to touch the West at all?
Splitting the global economy in two, a fortress China.
A fortress economy. If the cost of interacting with the system becomes too high, maybe they just stop trying and decide to build a wall instead.
And if that happens, the world we've known for the last 30 years is fundamentally over.
Heavy stuff. We'll be keeping a very close eye on this one. Thanks for listening to this deep dive.
My pleasure.
We'll see you next time.